Welcome, welcome, welcome back to Staying Power, a show that is all about resilience. What it is, what it isn't, how to know when we have it, what to do if we realize we don't have as much of it as we would like, and everything in between. And no matter what the case may be for you, resiliency in the end is a choice. That's what this show is about. And to joining me once again, as she does every week, to talk about our experiences helping people around the world develop their own resilience is my friend, my colleague, my co-host, co-author, so many things, Tawny Santabria. Hi, Tawny.
Hi. How's it going?
It's going pretty well. How about you? How are you?
Going pretty well. Yeah.
Rolling along.
Out there. Yeah. Out there pulling weeds earlier today.
Oh.
Love that.
I know. Yeah,
love it.
That's one of your favorite things. That's a metaphor we talk about in the book project that we're working on that, you know, some people will see someday. But that's a good one. So yeah, plus outdoors, exercise, movement, sounds pretty great.
And the soil is still damp and wet in a lot of parts because we had so much rain. So those weeds are just so, they helpful. Yeah. Like they just come on out, right? Yeah. Like pulling weeds in August is no fun.
That's true. Cause they make themselves known in the springtime, don't they? A lot more readily. Yeah.
Yes. And they just kind of come out with ease.
Absolutely.
Instead of like holding on for dear life since they haven't been
right
in a while.
Right. Well, and talk about a practice of resilience, right? Got to continue to pull weeds to keep a garden, right? So got to do that on a regular basis. All right. Okay. Well, this week, Tawny, you know, we love talking about all these different stories of resilience because we can find them anywhere, right? And it's one of the things we like to highlight on this show. And so a couple episodes back, you'd mentioned how you really like to hear stories that we didn't necessarily know much about until later on, right? Real life history stories, right? We talked about that. And so I've been kind of keeping my eye out for those types of things. And it's been kind of fun because I get to put my historian hat on and dig into stuff and go investigate. And I found a story that I think it's a little different than ones that we've done before in that this one is about larger community. Rather than around a single individual. But there's so many places in it that I thought, wow, there's so many examples of resilience and questions about it and thoughts about it that I thought I'd share about it. So as a way to introduce that, have you ever been to North Platte, Nebraska?
I have not been to Nebraska.
You've not been to Nebraska. I know you've been to South Dakota. But you've not been to Nebraska. Okay, well, North Platte is Nebraska is a town of around 24,000 people right now, and it's on Interstate 80, which runs right through the heart of the state of Nebraska. And North Platte is right where the South and the North Platte River meet, and it's right on the right where it meets there, and it's equidistant between Denver, Colorado, in the west, and Omaha, Nebraska, in the east, which means it's out in the middle of the country, almost literally in the middle of the country. And it's definitely farmland, Great Plains, everything we think of with Great Plains, farmhouses, that type of thing. It also has the biggest rail yard in the world. It's called Bailey Yard. It's a massive place. And it's been that way since the invention of the Transcontinental Railroad, the creation of it in the 1860s and 1870s. North Platte was made kind of a major place where engines would get repaired and crews could take breaks and that type of thing. So it's been that way for a really long time, and it's a central part of what makes North Platte, North Platte. But the story I want to tell you has to do with North Platte at a very difficult time in American history. And to do that, we need to roll back to December 25th, Christmas Day, of 1941. I want to tell you this story about that. So 20th century, if you know anything about history, you know this is just a few weeks after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor that brought the United States into World War II. And I don't mean you, Tawny. I know you know that. I mean our listeners. So sorry about that.
Yes, of course.
I wanted to make that clear. It sounded so snotty. I apologize for that. But that's what I mean. So that's what we're talking about. And on that day, for the first time, the so-called North Platte Canteen opened at the Union Pacific Railway Station at Bailey Yard. And what's significant about this is that after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, of course, a number of young men signed up for the military. And by the time Christmas rolled around, there were young men, for the most part, teenagers, sometimes just barely in their 20s, heading all over the country for military training. And they were traveling by train back then, as they did. And they were traveling east to west, west to east, depending on where they'd been assigned. And therefore, these trains were plentiful. They were full. And they were full of young kids, really worried, maybe really motivated to go fight, but really worried about their future and scared. And many of them leaving home for the first time to literally go into a world at war. And what happened on Christmas Day was, for the first time, it had been planned for a few weeks since the attack on Pearl Harbor. A number of women who lived in North Platte, working with a couple of local organizations and the local newspaper, decided, you know what, all those trains are going to stop here in North Platte because the engines are going to get service for about 10 minutes. What if we brought down all sorts of goodies that the troops could have? We could bring them we could bring them some food. We could just say hi to them. We could encourage them. How about we do that? And so they started doing this that day. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about it here in just a minute. But it started out with about 500 people who were doing this. But to put this in context, North Platte, in the years leading up to 1941, it had a really rough decade. The Great Depression, of course, was ongoing when the war started. And North Platte was part of the Dust Bowl in the 1930s. Had one of the worst droughts in the history of the United States. They were just coming out of that. A number of people were subsistence farmers still to that point, or they worked the rail yards, and pay wages were still very low. And so there had been a whole generation of people, young people in North Platte in particular, who'd grown up in real needy conditions, or had spent the greater part of the last decade in and more in really tough conditions. And so this act of baking cookies, getting eggs and hard boiling them, frying up chickens, baking cakes, all of this not only took time, but was also taking resources away from all the people in the town. And these were pretty scarce resources, at least by comparison today. And so, but they still decided they were going to do this because this was something that they believed these could really help these troops. And they turned out to be really right. Right. And so on December 25th, 1941, this began. All the way from that point, all the way up through when the canteen ended, April 1st, 1946, after the war was over and people were coming back, as many as 24 trains a day carrying 3,000 to 5,000 young men passed through North Platte and stopped there. And this canteen would meet there. In total, in that period, the men, women, and kids of North Platte served almost 6 million men and women at this canteen. It involved over 55,000 volunteers from over 125 different towns, some of them from as far as 200 miles away. People would converge for this. And they made this work despite wartime rationing that began during the war, which made things even more difficult. Organizers just got really creative. They donated extra ration stamps to be able to get more food to bring to the canteen, or they collected surplus farm produce, they pooled gas rations, so volunteers could travel from further away. And they raised a ton of money. By the end of the war, everybody together in North Platte had raised $138,000 to support this effort, which today is equivalent to $2.3 million. Not insignificant for a town at the time that was under 13,000 people. Okay, so pretty significant. So soldiers remembered this place. Now, over time, almost 120 different canteens appeared all over the country. By the end of the war, right, in various places in the South, the Pacific Northwest, in California, the Northeast, everywhere. But North Platte's was far and away the biggest, and everyone seemed to really remember it. Just to give you 1 month's rations, in March 1945, the canteen served a record 40,161 cookies, 30,679 hard-boiled eggs, 6,547 donuts, 2,400 loaves of bread, 2,800 pounds of meat. And on a typical day, they handed out about 1,000 cookies, 2,000 buns, 1,000 bottles of milk, 100 pounds of ham, 80 pounds of ground beef, 70 fried chickens, 720 hard-boiled eggs, 23 pounds of butter, 16 pounds of coffee, 2 crates of oranges and bushes and apples, and 36 birthday cakes on average. The birthday cakes was a big thing, and a number of soldiers wrote after the war that for some of them, it was the first birthday cake they'd ever gotten in their life. Was if they came through North Platte and it happened to be their birthday, they got a cake. And there were kids in North Platte who would go without a cake so they could take it down to the canteen and give it to a soldier who might have a birthday that day. It became a tradition. One kid in town, a kid named John Slattery, one day took the goats that he owned. His mom had told him to sell them because they kept eating her cherry bushes. And he sold them off and he donated the money to the canteen. The local newspaper asked him, well, can you donate anything else? He said, all I've got is the shirt off my back. Somebody heard him say that and said, hey, I'll buy that shirt and donate the money. So he literally bought the shirt off the kid's back. And when this story got into the newspaper, a local department store started giving John Slattery a new shirt whenever he sold one, and then people would buy the shirt and he would give it off. He raised by himself $2,000 during the war when he was a 10-year-old kid. That was one of those stories. And then just for one of the many stories, or two of the stories for soldiers, popcorn balls were really popular because, you know, you could make them. They were relatively cheap and people could hand them to the soldiers. And in some cases, women in North Platte would put in their address and their name and invite them to be pen pals. There are at least three people that we know of who met their spouses that way in North Platte and ended up living in North Platte for the rest of their lives. And every once in a while, farmers would bring in fried pheasants and would bring the feathers in of the pheasants. And these feathers became prized mementos for these soldiers going off to war. They would wear them in their hats. And at one point, a medic from overseas wrote in to the local newspaper in North Platte and said, I was just going through a field hospital and these seven soldiers would refuse to get surgery because the nurses were going to throw out these filthy, sweat-soaked pheasant feathers that they had stuffed in their boots. And they wouldn't budge. They wouldn't agree to be worked on until somebody guaranteed those feathers would be back. And so the doctor said, okay, clean those things with alcohol and make sure that they stay. Well, these were mementos that these guys got in North Platte. And it was a huge reminder of home. And for them, it was important enough to hold on to that and to remember, as they wrote later on, many of them, the kindness at a really vital time for them of the people in North Platte, the familiarity, people who look like their mothers, their sisters, their girlfriends, their wives, their kids, pouring out to give them what they had at a time of real need when they were scared to death and uncertain about where to go. And so this became something where the North Platte canteen was kind of known at the time among soldiers. It was certainly known in North Platte. It was certainly known in Nebraska. It achieved some fame here and there in newsreels during the war. But as soon as the war was over, it was largely forgotten for the most part. And in fact, in 1973, the depot was torn down where all of this had happened, despite the fact that they had served almost 6 million people by this point. And so what I found really interesting in all of this story, Tawny, was how many examples could we draw from, or could we talk about, where resilience is a part of this, right? As well as the importance of individual resilience and community resilience. There's so many things I could think of, but I wanted to put that in front of you to see what came up for you and see what we might be able to draw from it. So what do you think of that story?
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And aren't women great? Let's talk about that for a minute.
No doubt. No doubt.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And the simplicity,
mm-hmm.
right? It's just about having something that is of nourishment,
mm-hmm.
or that is enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fixing any major problems. It's not creating any major problems. It's not saying we should be this or you should do that, or you should be this way, or you should feel this way, or you shouldn't feel that way, or not any of that. It's just here. A meal, mm-hmm. a birthday cake, mm-hmm. some bread, right? And really what that does to connect us all, and that sense of sort of like just feeling taken care of.
Yeah.
With food,
mm-hmm.
with resources,
mm-hmm.
with something that is simple, but meaningful nonetheless, sort of like you're important, like, and that small way that we can, you know, certainly we're in a different generational place in our existence at mm-hmm. this point compared mm-hmm. to in the 40s for sure. And so, you know, we didn't have a lot of as much of the technological complexities and a lot of the thinking stuff. We had, there was a lot more doing
mm-hmm.
that needed to occur back then. And so, right. What's the simple thing to do?
Mm-hmm.
Make some bread.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. And there's some of that happening now, in the sense of like we're sort of starting to see ourselves kind of go back to more of, you know, really crave some of that simplicity.
Yeah.
And really be able to nourish ourselves and our family and our communities in more simple ways.
Mm-hmm.
That's not for today, but yeah, but how significant. And then it just grew and grew and grew, right? Like, who doesn't want to be a part of that?
Right. 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 Absolutely. Yeah. When you think of a town, what can a town do to be invested in a war that's happening far, far away, but is decidedly personal, right? I mean, I kept thinking each one of these people showing up and doing this work is going to know somebody who went to war, right? Is going to know plenty of people who went to war, and they're going to be encountering young men who are going to remind them of their sons and their brothers and their husbands and all of that. And it's what better way to be engaged in something and to feel like you're contributing to something than something like that.
Yeah. And I think too, I mean, it's more than that even, because they're physically moving through the town.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's more than about, you know, certainly it's a difficult time and everybody knew where they were headed in terms of that journey. Right. Mm-hmm. But they were actually moving through the town.
Mm-hmm.
So they were in the same physical space.
Yeah.
That's a completely different sort of experience. You really get to connect.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get to do that as much.
Yeah.
Anymore. So it wasn't just about, doing something for something larger somewhere else. It was really like, wow, this is going through our town. How do we ignore this?
Mm-hmm.
What can we do during these stops? I mean, this is like real life here.
Yeah.
Instead of focusing on, you know, all the things that are going on so far away from us, this is a great example of like, let's focus on what's actually happening here.
Mm-hmm.
And they had that opportunity to be able to do that, as opposed to being, you know, sort of like the attention going to somewhere so far away that there's nothing to do.
Right.
So far away. Like, what can we do here, mm-hmm, in our physical space?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And those darn women, man, let them bake some cookies, let them bake a cake. They're all over it. Yeah. Right. Love, mm-hmm, it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's so funny because, it happened. It actually ended up happening by accident. I didn't mention this at the front end, but I mentioned it began on the 25th, but originally word had gotten out through the newspaper on December 17th, just 10 days after Pearl Harbor, a troop train was going to be passing through that they were told was going to be a company of Nebraska National Guard. Well, it turned out when the train showed up, it was the Kansas National Guard. It wasn't the Nebraska National Guard. But the reaction of the soldiers, including one who had a birthday that day, and they just happened to have a cake and gave it to him, is what really kicked off the idea, you know. And, it was a 26-year-old woman named Ray Wilson who began the process of organizing that. Now, it eventually got so exhausting to her that she handed that over and moved to California. But nevertheless, so absolutely. I mean, it's something that, to me, in the context of what was happening, and it's exactly like you said, people took control over something they could take control of and did something that they knew they could do, and were involved in acts of giving and sharing that were very important to them as people and in that community, and applied it here. And you're right, it's a 10-minute stop. It was literally only a 10-minute stop. And so I just have this vision of 24 to 25 trains coming in per day, which is, if it's 24 hours, is an average of two every hour, which was probably more because it was mostly daylight probably. But then just, what did that look like? I mean, the organization to do that in a small space and to make sure every soldier had an opportunity to get something. It must have just been a real immense exercise in cooperation, learning as you went, working together, streamlining, learning through trial and error. I mean, it must have just been something to behold.
And They went, and it wasn't unlike what they were used to at that time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. Because coordination needed to happen in the same physical space mm-hmm. at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Whether it was small group and, or, you know, large families getting together, like certainly this was on a more massive scale, but they already had the foundation set around how do we do this in the physical space where everybody's sort of doing a part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it be farming, whether it be raising large families, whether it be, you know, the communities that were working together, because that's where the focus was,
mm-hmm.
was in our community. And so they certainly learned with each stop how to refine, probably. I'm sure. Making an assumption.
Oh, yeah.
If they kept going, right? But it sort of grew. So it was like something that grew into something. Had they known what it was going to be at the out, you know, further on down the road, they might have gotten stuck. Like, how are we going to even do this? How do we even do this? Why? We can't do this, right? Mm. Because it would have been too big to conceptualize, right? So they took step one, said, oh, let's just do this. And didn't really probably think too far ahead of that.
Right.
Like we like to do now.
Sure.
Oh, forget right now. We want to look at what can this be, you know, down the road in 6 months? What do we want it to be in 6 months? Well, wait a second. It's not even what I want it to be right now.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't I just think about right now what I can do? What can I do in a small way right now?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then 6 months will take care of itself. But that that focus of just right now. I'm making a lot of assumptions, but I'm that coordination that they already knew needed to happen. They already knew how to do this
mm-hmm.
on the small scale.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are not only sound assumptions, but they're actually backed up by some of the books that have been written about this, that indeed there was that, because, you know, we know how the war ended now, right? We know how long it took. We know what the cost was. At the time, they did not, and it had not started out well at all. And even during the war, the prognostications of how long the war was going to go sometimes stretched for well beyond what it ended up being, a little over 4 years. And so some authors who've written about it have said exactly what you said. Talk about a place to be right now, do something right now, and you just keep doing it each day, right? Because that's what it was going to take. And that's all you could really do. So, and if any listeners are interested in learning more about the North Platte, the North Platte Canteen, as it's known to history, and various books that are about that. There was an article in Smithsonian Magazine, which is where I found out about this story, began researching it. We've provided the link to that story in the episode notes for this episode, both if you're listening as a podcast and at the KKNW 1150 AM website where our show is. You can see it there and read it for yourself. It's a good assumption backed up by a historical narrative, Tawny. So you did well there.
Excellent. Thank you. I just know that if I don't know for sure, I know I'm taking just a jump. So I'm just wanting to
sure.
make sure that there's room for me to have a wrong assumption.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. Absolutely. and you know, and the other thing too about historical narratives, they don't capture every single story. Right. They just don't, no matter the size of the subject at hand. Right. No one person can be really described in all that they are in history. Not one movement, not one country, not one era. So certainly I think these are major ingredients there. And to me, I think that's what's so fascinating about all of this, because what you mentioned about they were already doing these things in their communities. Right. And this was in some ways an extension of that. It's very true, because, you know, the Depression in the years leading up to that were going to have required that, you know, made that an absolute necessity, sharing, bartering, sacrificing, right? Limiting things down, because, of course, they were limiting their own supplies, right? You know, of what they had for themselves by doing this. And yet, you know, and this is where my assumption is, which I think is backed up by some of the stuff I read. As time went by and soldiers came back or were traveling back through having been discharged, they would stop and share stories about how important the experience was for them. And so they began to get feedback over time and letters to the newspaper that got printed locally that they were getting word of how important this was, right? And how positive of an experience this was for soldiers. And so they would start, you know, something else to fuel it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, feedback is always really important, right? Yeah. So being able to have that certainly would continue the process. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless it's bad feedback, but this was probably, this sounds like it was good feedback.
Sounds like it was pretty good. Yeah. Sounds like it was pretty good overall anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was a great story. And I thought it was one that it didn't really become all that talked about or written about outside of North Platte until the 1970s, when people began taking a look at it and they tore down the Union Station Depot and a bunch of people said, wait, we got to save all this stuff. This was kind of an important thing. So anyway, there you go. Yeah, there you have it.
Thank you. Thank you
right.
for that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'm glad you liked it. And thanks for your insight on that. I think that's so much in there we can pull about resilience. So thanks so much for that, Tawny. And thanks to all of you listening for tuning in for this episode of Staying Power. Remember, if you missed any of this episode or any of our other episodes, you can get this as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And when you subscribe to Staying Power, you also get a mini podcast called The Four that pops up in your feed every week. Four tips, 4 points, 4 ideas that you can apply directly in your day in, day out life and see what it does for you in terms of helping you develop your own resilience. And if you would like to support the show more, you can check out the Staying Power Network on Patreon that you can join for free or you can upgrade for a few perks. And the link for that is in our show notes for this. And it's also available at the KKNW 1150 AM website where our show resides on the radio side. So you can check that out. And there's a lot more content there and lots of other fun things for you to check out, including the latest updates on what we're doing. So, whew, that was a mouthful.
So, you made it.
I made it.
You made it.
I made it. We made it to the end. And we will be seeing you again next week, everyone, on another episode of Staying Power. And until then, I am JDK Winnikin.
And I'm Tawny Santabria.
See you later. Now I want a birthday cake.